Welcome to Physicians Weekly.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Physicians Weekly's podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Rachel Giles from Medical Medical Publishers, in collaboration with Physicians Weekly.
The Physicians Weekly podcast provides thought leader insights on the latest medical news, clinical trial coverage, and advances in medicine and healthcare.
In today's episode, we have two interviews, as usual. Later in this podcast, Physicians Weekly's frequent contributor, a board-certified radiologist and medical malpractice lawyer, who goes by the pseudonym Dr. Medlaw for this show, tells us all about what you need to think about and do, as well as not do, when you are in a delicate and tricky situation where you have to report another doctor. But before that, we speak with Professor Tony Schirreri. He's from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute at Harvard University, and he's talking about kidney cancer and one of the major new findings that was discussed at ASCO's Genitourinary Cancer Symposium, which was held the 16th through the 18th of February in 2023 in San Francisco, so just last weekend. I was there in person, and I was able to get some interviews there. I learned so much. Now, Tony, I ran into him on the street, so apologies for the background noise. And he uses a few acronyms and nicknames, like NIVO for nivolumab, IPI for ipilimumab, CABO for cabozantinib, and TFS for treatment-free survival. This study, called CheckMate 9ER, is a phase 3 trial that was published last year in the New England Journal of Medicine. And this is looking at the 3.5-year follow-up. Enjoy listening.
Hi, Tony Schirreri from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. I came all the way from Boston to San Francisco, and it's actually colder in San Francisco.
And can you just start off by talking about the extended efficacy and safety data?
Very happy with this extended data, 44 months that Dr. Mauricio Barotto really presented. The CR rate over 10%, PFS maintained, the OS 1 year more on average, and there could be some tail of the curve. And what I'm the most excited about is safety data. We tend to forget safety data for patients. Now with more follow-up and more patient on cabozantinib nivolumab, there is no new safety signal. So this is kind of really assuring for the patients. It was very important to see if there is any new safety effect from that combination. No new safety signals. One interesting thing, and Dr. Barotto commented on that well, is the CR rate. The complete response rate now is, you know, consistently over 10% in CheckMate 9ER. And I start seeing, if you look at the intermediate poor, I start seeing also a tail of the curve emerging in the combination with immunotherapy, which is something very, very encouraging. So we're happy with the data. This is good for patient, very good news for patient. And we continue, you know, looking at biomarkers. Actually, we presented earlier during the day the first biomarker from CheckMate 9ER. It was very important. It wasn't the first VEGF-IO biomarker in motion, 151, 150, Javelin Renal 101. Were presented before. However, these are all PD-L1 inhibitor-based biomarkers. Here we presented the first PD-1-based VEGF inhibitor. And, you know, looked at the usual suspect, PD-L1, CD8, CMET. None of them were predictive for one arm versus, you know, another. Some prognostic signal. But what's important, and we're going to take a look in this into more details, is that the gene expression signatures we're used to, the angiogenic signature, the T effector signature, the Javelin Renal 101 signature that we've developed with Pfizer and with Paul Robbins and Bob Modzer, were not predictive, at least, in for Cabo Nevo. So could be that these signature we're, you know, deriving are signature specific, not for class effect, as much as for the actual drugs. So more remain to be seen, and just very proud, especially about the biomarker data, how academic and patients and industry are working together. And we're designing them at the time of the actually clinical trial design. We're incorporating biomarkers, finally.
Thank you for that. So I know it's not really good science, but can you compare the CheckMate 9ER long-term results to earlier results, maybe IO, other first line?
Yeah, I think we can compete with nivolumab, ipilimumab long-term result, the median minimum follow-up is 5 years. And, you know, I mean, this is really hard to compare. And the one thing interesting with this ipilimumab boost, it may give you that tail on the curve. It's really hard to compare. But the VEGF-IO in general, the one approved, have been somewhat, you know, similar. The hazard ratio for OS has been, you know, quite impressive initially. Then we lose a bit of that despite the statistical significance. The CR rate we start seeing with time. I think we need at some point trial that look at treatment-free survival when we can initiate treatment again. Dr. Atkins presented some of that. It remains really undefined how to design a randomized trial with TFS as the primary endpoint, but I think it's gonna come out there at some point.
Okay, last question before I let you go on. So how will this change the extended to CheckMate 9ER specifically? How will that change your practice? Do you feel more confidence?
Oh, I think it gives me more proof that I think this combination is solid and safe. I think it's very important. Safety, we tend to forget safety for patients. And we think, okay, this is the first data cutoff. There isn't anything major. Well, what about the 2-3 years follow-up? So I'm happy with the safety result. I'm happy how the overall survival, end up. And there was no change in PFS or response rate. So I'm more and more confident.
Solid data.
Solid data.
And if it gets the tail of the end of the curve, what would that mean for
perhaps then we can hold one of the treatment. Maybe we can hold either the TKI, continue immuno, vice versa, both. I think that's very important because at the end of the day, the patient want to be treatment-free and want to be alive for the longest period of time. That's what everyone wants. That's what everyone tells me in clinic.
Thank you so much.
You're always, so cool. Always my pleasure. It's really colder than Boston.
Physicians Weekly is back again with our regular contributor, Dr. Medlaw, a board-certified radiologist and medical malpractice attorney, this time to discuss reporting a doctor. Dr. Medlaw, thank you for joining us today.
Great to be here.
We've been talking in the last few podcasts about liability when a doctor refers a patient to another doctor or recommends another doctor to a new employer. How about if the doctor is not in those situations, but they come to believe that another doctor is impaired or incompetent?
Well, that's when things get really difficult for doctors who find themselves in that position. I mean, there's always a primary desire to protect the patient. You know, you're a doctor, that's what you do. And there's also professional offense of bad medicine being practiced. But there's also the fear of being considered disloyal to the profession or facing retaliation by the other doctor. And there's also the role of the state that may actually be dictating the choice.
What do you mean by that?
Well, licensure comes with a role as a mandated reporter. States will have some version of a requirement that physicians practicing in the state, and that includes physicians who are just visiting, are obligated to report if they believe that another doctor basically poses a continuing threat to the public welfare through their practice of medicine.
But that can be very subjective.
Well, exactly. And that's why there's a backup option. Rather than reporting to the state, you know, really bringing the hammer down, a physician who suspects that another doctor is a risk to patients but is not quite sure that the problematic conduct rises to a level that requires reporting to the state medical board should instead report to a practice committee. They're going to have the resources to, you know, to fully evaluate the matter. Doing nothing, though, that's not a permissible option. Once your suspicions are raised, your own license could, frankly, be in jeopardy if it's later determined that you knew about the problem and failed to act.
But will they really be at that risk? In another podcast, we talked about Dr. Christopher Dunch, who is now serving a life sentence for harming patients. All the doctors and facilities just passed him along and never reported him to the Texas Medical Board. None of them were sanctioned for that.
Okay, well, frankly, that risk is low. But that's in no way, however, to say that doctors should not follow the law. There's a fundamental ethical requirement to uphold the profession, and that's legally codified into the reporting requirement that stems from the privilege to practice in the particular state. But admittedly, the most likely liability for a doctor who knows that another doctor is practicing dangerously is actually going to be one that derives from a fiduciary relationship that they personally have rather than a general duty to the public health.
Who would that fiduciary relationship be with?
Well, it could be with their practice or it could be to a patient.
Let's start with the practice issue.
All right. If you're a partner in a practice, you're a fiduciary to that practice. You're obligated to protect the interests of the practice. So if you know or suspect that a member of the group or a doctor the group refers to is impaired or professionally incompetent, you have an absolute obligation to make that known to the rest of the group, or you can be liable for damages that that doctor then causes to the group.
This sounds a lot like what we discussed as far as a duty to a subsequent employer if you provide a letter of reference.
Well, it is similar in that there can be liability for what the deficient doctor does at the next practice if you give them a falsely good recommendation that the new employer relies on. However, there, the duty is to be truthful if you choose to write a letter at all. There's no duty to actually warn them as there is within your own practice.
What if you are an employee rather than a partner?
Well, then there's no actual fiduciary duty, but there can still be liability on the same logical basis. If you don't speak up, the group can hold you liable for losses it incurs because you didn't alert it to the problem. This would also apply to your relationship to your hospital. Your privileges agreement likely contains a reporting requirement, subject to hospital bylaws. So these situations are contractual rather than fiduciary. But they come down to liability for breaching a contract as to notification if the group or the hospital is then damaged by the doctor you failed to warn it about.
How about the patient issue?
Well, if a patient is seeing both you and the deficient physician, and it's clear to you that your patient is at actual risk, and this is important, that means it's not just a mere difference of opinion with the other doctor. You have an obligation to act through your own fiduciary relationship with the patient. You should first try to discuss the patient's care with the other doctor. Maybe they can justify what they're doing. But if you come away from that discussion convinced that your patient remains at risk, your own duty to your patient requires you to intervene to prevent that harm.
So how should that be done?
Well, this is where what you have to do gets very individualized. You start with the least intrusive approach, and it may be enough to offer the patient an alternative or to suggest that they seek a second opinion. And of course, you would document that you did so. If those approaches fail, then you'd have to start becoming more explicit about the failings that you've identified. But the important part is you have to keep that solely professional rather than derisive. And that's, of course, a hedge against a defamation claim against you from the other doctor, but it's also a practical issue. You want the patient to see the matter as purely about care. It's not a vendetta. It's not a pissing contest, because if it's about care, then they're more likely to follow your advice.
Where does confidentiality fit into reporting requirements?
Well, in general, it won't overlap because the other doctor will be someone whom you know or know of in a professional setting that is not subject to confidentiality. It can be a unique situation, though, if you come to know about the other doctor's deficiencies because they're your patient. In that setting, you want to use your role as their treater to get them to seek help and to restrict their practice until that's done. However, if they refuse and indicate their intention to continue to practice in a manner that you know is unsafe, then your mandated reporter status will kick in, and your doctor-patient cannot restrain you. You know, they can't cite HIPAA or state confidentiality law from you fulfilling that. Now, that having been said, you want to vet the matter with the state medical board first. And do that vetting in writing so that you'll have proof of what they told you. That's because you're permitted to rely on the board's instructions. And so if you're later charged with liability for breaching confidence, the fact that you followed lawful instructions from the governing medical body of your state, that'll be your defense.
What if you find out about the other doctor from a patient to whom you owe confidentiality, but they tell you not to say anything.
Again, the mandated reporter role takes precedence. That's consistent with the fact that state boards can obtain medical records as part of a disciplinary investigation, even if the patient objects. Their public health role supersedes. However, the same proviso applies that we just mentioned. Let the board tell you how to proceed operationally so you can fall back on that instruction if you're challenged later. Now, also, even in that setting, the overarching obligation to reveal only the PHI that is necessary still applies. Don't volunteer more information than is needed to make your concerns clear. And this is important, keep the patient's identity shielded at the outset. You know, remember that PHI only becomes PHI when it's identifiable. If the board then wants more records or to know who the patient is, well, the demand will come from them in their official capacity, and you'll be immunized for your compliance.
At the beginning, you mentioned worrying about retaliation. How does that factor in?
Well, as we mentioned earlier, the doctor you report may turn around and sue you for defamation. They may also make a complaint of their own to the medical board, claiming that you acted improperly and solely to harm them. They could also sue you for tortious interference with business, you know, claiming that you're only misrepresenting the quality of their work to interfere in the relationships that they have with patients and referrers. So you want to make sure that you start off at the standard that reporting statutes actually contemplate, which is reasonable certainty that you're correct. They require this because it moves the issue past things like personal dislike or economic competition that could influence someone's judgment. Now, on the other hand, you're not required to be a detective. You're required to satisfy yourself that you're not, for example, acting on a targeted allegation by a colleague or patient who themselves has a grievance against the other doctor, or you're not just listening to scuttlebutt. Simply then, you don't want to act unless you have what you can present as proof of your own diligence in verifying before reporting. And this brings us back to the fact that you can refer to a practice committee that can investigate better than you can. So in that setting, your protective step would be to show that you verified as best you could before that referral and didn't just jump the gun in a way that could ruin another doctor.
Reporting requirements seem harsh, and that's understandable because there should be a zero tolerance for deficient physicians practicing on unsuspecting patients. But what if you have a colleague or a physician patient with a competence issue or an impairment, and you want to help them?
Well, the state itself may have a safe harbor for someone who has an impairment like substance abuse or a treatable physical condition and who is willing to accept intervention. Reporting may be able to be deferred if they comply with treatment guidelines, such as through a physician health committee. A professional incompetence is a slightly different issue because it would have to be dealt with on an ad hoc basis, depending on the actual problem. The doctor with the issue could be required to retrain or to be observed until they've demonstrated proficiency, while their practices are limited until that proficiency is demonstrated. And that would provide the protection of patients that reporting is directed to. That having been said, unless you're a solo practitioner without hospital privileges, you will also likely have reporting obligations as far as your group and facility, as we discussed earlier. And those may not have a carve-out. So before you DIY yourself an option for a friend or a physician patient, make sure of the constraints that you're actually under.
So what are the takeaways on this topic?
First, there's a basic obligation deriving from being allowed to practice in a state to report deficient practitioners. And confidentiality is not a bar to that. There can be fiduciary obligations to do so within a practice or based on the doctor-patient relationship. And there can also be a contractual duty to report for employees or for doctors with privileges. A doctor with limitations who's willing to seek help and to meet standards for getting that help may not have to be reported, but the requirements for that deferral have to be met. And finally, a doctor who will be making what will be an official report to a licensing body or to their practice or to their hospital should first vet the allegation that they're making to a reasonable degree of certainty, because that will be their defense if the doctor they reported then retaliates.
Dr. Medlaw, thank you for joining us.
And as always, thanks for the chance to talk about this important topic.
That's all the time we have for today's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe and stay healthy.
Physicians Weekly is produced in collaboration with Medicom Medical Publishers and Physicians Weekly.